Paradise This Week. I'm Scarlett Fu. This podcast has the best and most interesting interviews from the Daily Market Close show that I co-anchor with Joe Weisenthal, Caroline Hyde, and Romain Bostic on Bloomberg Television. What'd you miss? Our aim is to take you beyond the headlines and bring you unique perspective on the week's top stories and those you may just have missed. It was another week of What'd You Miss from home. Now, throughout the week, President Trump intensified his confrontation with China. It all came to a head on Friday afternoon with a Rose Garden press conference. There, the president vowed to punish Beijing for the coronavirus pandemic, as well as its plans to curb Hong Kong's autonomy. Trump said the U.S. would begin a process to revoke Hong Kong's preferential trade status under U.S. law and deny visas to Chinese officials. We got insight from Bonnie Glazer, senior advisor for Asia and director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. We began by asking Bonnie how damaging these moves would be to the U.S.-China relationship.
Well, the president certainly used sweeping rhetoric and condemned China's national security laws that are now going to be written and enacted against Hong Kong. But he was unclear about what measures will be taken by the United States against China and potentially against Hong Kong. He did say that there will be some special privileges that Hong Kong has that are likely to be eliminated, and he specifically mentioned the extradition treaty. He talked about potential limits on dual-use technology, but he said that there would be exceptions. He also mentioned export controls, and he said that the State Department will adjust its travel advisory for citizens going to Hong Kong. But he was not concrete about when these actions will take place and how comprehensive they will be. He didn't mention removing Hong Kong's special trading status.
Yeah, the lack of details, I mean, is definitely concerning. And I'm wondering whether, Bonnie, you see it as a factor or an issue for folks who are doing business either in Hong Kong or with Hong Kong in some manner, whether they just stick around and just wait this out and wait for those details, or whether they just kind of pack up and move on.
Well, I think it's going to depend. There will be some people who may see the handwriting on the wall and companies who decide that now is the time to leave. But my expectation is people are going to wait for a while. They're going to try and see exactly what the United States is going to do. Are other countries going to follow? China will probably enact this law over the next couple of months, and then we move into a phase of implementation. What are the Chinese actually going to do? So my guess is a large number of companies are going to want to wait it out.
The problem now between China and the U.S. and the rhetoric that we have is that we're in a cycle where every action or announcement demands a response. And this can ratchet up very quickly to something that is difficult for either side to back down from. Do you see any path to a graceful off-ramp, any way for either side to, using a Chinese phrase and a Chinese expression, get off the stage and still save face?
Well, it's possible maybe after the presidential elections. I don't see it happening sooner. I think for President Trump, China is a useful target to blame, a punching bag he can use as he runs for re-election and tries to distract attention away from his own performance in stopping the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States. And for Xi Jinping, he has a domestic audience, and he has to be tough on the United States. So there will be actions that will be taken against the United States if the U.S. imposes sanctions on Chinese officials and entities, which was also mentioned by President Trump today.
You know, I'm curious, Bonnie, we talk a lot about the U.S.-China relationship from the perspective of the U.S. for obvious reasons, because we're here, and this idea of what the U.S. wants, what Trump wants. Do we have any real sense here of what Xi Jinping wants out of its relationship with the U.S.?
Well, for many years, the United States has been a top priority for China, of course, even before Xi Jinping, but continuing through Xi Jinping's presidency. China has benefited from a stable and predictable relationship with the United States. And President Trump has really pulled out the rug from under Xi Jinping on that score. And so it seems to me that the Chinese are questioning whether or not it is possible to have a stable relationship with the United States going forward. And I think there are some people in China who are saying that this may be impossible. And when it comes to core interests, and of course, Hong Kong is one of those, Taiwan is, Xinjiang, that China should not attach much weight to U.S. Statements and policies going forward, that it just has to do what serves China's own interests.
So it kind of disregards whatever the U.S. has to say about any of these core interests. What do people get wrong the most when it comes to China's intent with Taiwan? And I ask this because the one country, two systems that President Trump denounced as really one country, one system is something that China has been trying to sweeten Taiwan with, or trying to pitch to Taiwan, with limited success, of course.
Well, I think that there's been a lot of statements over the course of this week with the National People's Congress in Beijing, and some fears that China was revising its policy toward Taiwan and dropping its goal of peaceful unification. But at the end of the day, I think what is clear is that Xi Jinping is not in a phase now. It's not in his interest to change that strategy. China still hopes to implement some version of one country, two systems in Taiwan. It still wants to rely on its relationship with the KMT and the consensus that was reached back in 1992, that both sides of the strait are part of one China. So I think a lot of people believe that China is poised to use military weapons to attack Taiwan. I just don't think that is going to happen in the near term. It's on the table. It's an option, absolutely. But an attack on Taiwan, I think, would be extraordinarily detrimental to PRC interests at this particular point in time. And so I don't see a change in China's strategy.
Then we got perspective on how the rising tensions are weighing on currency markets. Win Thin, global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman, joined us, outlining the best and worst case scenarios for investors.
Well, I think the worst case scenario is we go back to trade restrictions. You know, we had a taste of this back throughout 2019. We had this so-called a trade war between the two largest countries and economies in the world. I fear that's sort of the worst case we can go back to. You know, obviously the last time we had tariffs during a recession, well, that was back in the Great Depression with the Smoot-Hawley Act. So that's really, you know, the last thing the global economy needs right now is another round of trade tensions and tariffs and restrictions and what have you. That's the worst case. The best case is we get some sort of limited action, and we've already gotten a taste of that. You probably saw overnight the U.S. is talking about expelling Chinese students that have ties to the PLA. To me, are somewhat minor. But the problem with these kind of these sort of tensions is that tempers can flare, accidents happen, misunderstandings happen, and I fear that this is going to really turn into much more of a tit-for-tat thing. Again, this was okay in 2019 when the global economy was, for the most part, strong. But when we are in a global recession, this is the last thing we need.
So, I mean, then how do you prepare for this? And I'm talking from an investment perspective, and for those folks out there who are trying to prepare for this or trying to trade off of this, I guess the question it becomes is, how much can an escalation on a political level actually translate into some sort of pain on it, some sort of economic or financial level, given that tariffs are already in place and they're already relatively high?
Of course. Again, the problem is that it's escalating something even deeper. And I think, again, the key factor is that this is coming at a time when we are already in global recession. So really, we have just no margin for error. We saw how significantly the markets can be impacted by this sort of measures back throughout 2019. We're a lot of headline-driven stock rallies and stock sell-offs due to really tensions between the U.S. and China. So to me, this is almost a replay of that. Again, at a much worse time. For this part, I would say China has been very quiet. They really have not responded back in force. I think part of that was the fact that the Chinese leadership was going into the National People's Congress last weekend and didn't want to roil the markets. But I think now that's out of the way, I think the gloves are off. I think the Hong Kong move was just the beginning. It was an indirect confrontation. Hmm. But I expect much more direct confrontation coming forward. And again, this can easily spill over from the political realm into the economic realm.
And into the financial markets realm as well, because we've seen the offshore yuan, for instance, fall to record lows, and it's holding right around there right now. Is that the best way to see the tensions reflected in financial markets through pairs like the offshore yuan?
Well, it's funny you say that, Scarlett. I think at this point it's the only way you can see it. And, you know, I think myself and many other investment professionals are really, quite frankly, bewildered that the markets are shrugging this off so far. If you look at the equity market, you would think there's U.S.-China tensions. If you look at the Hong Kong dollar, you wouldn't think there was any tensions between China and Hong Kong. You know, really, the only way it's being reflected right now is in the yuan, which is puzzling. So to me, that's sort of the canary in the coal mine. We've had Aussie dollars start to weaken a bit, too, because they're having tensions with China. So I would say those are the two pairs to watch. I do think they are the leaders, and that the if these tensions do ratchet up, I think most of the other markets will sort of revert to form. Equities should soften, emerging markets should soften, all the sort of risk assets should soften. Japanese yen, Swiss franc probably would gain in this scenario, and the dollar as well.
And just how much of a defense, though, do you think we're going to see the PBOC make on the yuan beyond what it's done already?
Well, that's the interesting thing. To its credit, again, China, the policymakers have really been trying to tamp down on turmoil. So yes, the yuan is weakening, but they've been fixing the yuan, sort of stronger than the models would suggest. So they're not feeding into the yuan weakness. They're sort of leaning against it. I think that would open up a whole new set of can of worms. But the markets, as you can see through CNH, that's freely tradable. Believe otherwise, and they've been taking dollar CNH much higher on the expectation that these tensions are going to worsen.
This was supposed to be a historic week for SpaceX, and still could be on Saturday. The company founded by Elon Musk was looking to make history on Wednesday with NASA. The plan was for two astronauts to take off for the International Space Station, marking the first launch of U.S. astronauts into space from domestic soil in almost 9 years, and SpaceX's first manned mission into space. But Florida's storm weather forecast got in the way, and the flight was delayed until Saturday afternoon. We got reaction from Sean Casey, Vice President for Business Development at Atlas Space Operations. Sean is also co-founder of the Silicon Valley Space Center. We started by asking what exactly has to happen to ensure a safe launch.
There are usually just a couple of criteria that are the launch weather criteria, and they are activities that are within 5 to 10 miles of the launch site, and that includes lightning and freezing temperatures. Today's launch was scrubbed because of electric fields, electric field intensity, which is usually a precursor to lightning, and so the launch was scrubbed just right before we started the liquid oxygen load, because we already had RP-1 loaded on the vehicle, which is the basic petroleum fuel, and liquid oxygen is the oxidizer. So the last thing you want is to have a lightning strike with a fully loaded vehicle, and that's why they canceled today's mission and rescheduled it for May 30th.
And we had seen headlines earlier this afternoon from NASA saying that the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket was already fueled. Do they have to undo everything and redo everything in the next attempt, or can they kind of, I don't know, I mean, this is a dumb question, but just put a cover on it and be ready to go on Saturday?
No, this is a unique thing about the Falcon 9 is that it's fueled right before launch. And this was a point of contention with NASA and SpaceX. The RP-1 is started just within 30 minutes, and then, the last 16 minutes is when they load the liquid oxygen. What they're going to do is they're going to offload the fuel, and then once they offload the fuel, then it's safe for people to approach the vehicle.
So, Sean, when we talk about just kind of the historic nature of this, I mean, obviously you kind of have to go back to the 50s, the creation of NASA and the space race and putting a man on the moon in the 60s, and, of course, the shuttle program. NASA, at this point, appears to have seeded most of the development of the physical aspect of getting folks and things into space to private companies, whether it's SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, Blue Origin, or whoever. Are we pretty much committed to this as a nation, that the future of U.S. space flight and U.S. space involvement is going to be driven by the technology that these private companies provide?
Well, I like to look at it in terms of risk and what private companies know. You know, we had 50 years of NASA's cost-plus contracts where it was very hard to assess the risk associated with a particular mission. For going to low Earth orbit, you know, we did it for Gemini and the Mercury, the Gemini and the Apollo programs, and for the shuttle. So there's a lot of industry knowledge about what's required to do this. So I think for those programs where investors can assess risk, then that's kind of the foundations of putting your money forward in a private company as an investment, like what you see in SpaceX and Virgin Orbit and Blue Origin. There are going to be those programs that are still inherently risky, where NASA is going to have to absorb the risk, and I expect those kinds of programs are going to be cost-plus programs because private industry has a hard time assessing the risk. Mm. But for these programs, like what we're seeing with SpaceX, this is a fixed-cost contract, and that's because there's some aspects of it that the risk is known, and private companies can accept that risk.
Okay, so this is part of NASA's Commercial Crew Program, and my understanding is that it moves the agency, NASA, closer eventually to putting the first woman and next man on the moon in 2024. That's the Artemis program. Walk us through what needs to happen before that can take place.
Well, those are some tough milestones. The first thing we need to do is to have the human-rated vehicles certified by NASA, like what we're seeing today with the SpaceX vehicle and what we'll see later on this year with the Boeing vehicles. There's an entirely different program from the Commercial Crew, which is the NASA lunar effort. For that, NASA has released contracts to three companies, SpaceX, Blue Origin, and Dynetics, and each of them have a different approach to going to space. For the SpaceX program, they're actually planning on using their new Starship vehicle, which is still under the development stage. That will also have to be certified for human spaceflight, and they're going to have to go through a certification process similar to what the Falcon 9 has gone through. So there are a lot of milestones to do. The SpaceX mission today, we had to go through about 20 separate milestones for human certification of that vehicle. I'd imagine a separate, 20 to 30 milestones will have to be accomplished, because it's not only just getting to low Earth orbit, but then the transition to a lunar orbit, and then the lunar lander program as well. So it's going to be just twice, if not three times, as complicated as what we've gone through for this mission with SpaceX and also with Boeing.
So, Sean, I mean, in terms of the manned spaceflight, then, I mean, what is sort of the longer-term ambition here? Because we geek out over this stuff. It's obviously just an amazing feat of human ingenuity here. But is there sort of a practical reason why we're going back to the moon, why we're looking to go maybe even beyond the moon?
Sure. I think a lot of those reasons are for commercially motivated. NASA has just recently started a LEO commercialization, low Earth orbit, commercialization of low Earth orbit. The International Space Station is a destination for both governments and companies to operate in a microgravity environment. NASA is looking at a wide variety of companies that include the usual suspects that are Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, but also includes Blue Origin and Sierra Nevada and some new entrants like NanoRacks and Axiom that are looking to build either modules that attach to the ISS or free-flying modules. Those platforms will serve as anchor points for more human operation in low Earth orbit. So this is something that comes out of our existing work on the International Space Station and just pushes it into the commercial sector. As for going back to the moon, well, there are a lot of things. If you talk to the mineralogists and, you know, people out of the oil and gas industry, they will tell you that you really only know just a rudimentary number of things about the lunar environment and what the resources are that are embedded within the lunar surface. So that's certainly more of a stretch, but it's very important that we go back to the moon in order to prove out those models.
The coronavirus pandemic rapidly changed the way we work, with companies being forced to shift their employees to remote setups, like this podcast. We spoke about this labor market change with Adam Ozimek, chief economist at Upwork. Adam surveyed 1,500 hiring managers before and after the virus outbreak and published a report that investigates the long-term impacts of this remote work experiment and what we can anticipate in the future. He joined us to share his findings.
I think it's not really surprising that a lot of workers enjoy working from home. It's less commute. They don't have to get up as early in the morning. They don't have to wear a suit. But I think what makes our survey really interesting is we ask the decision makers. We ask the people who are going to be deciding what the remote work hiring looks like in the future, how the experience has gone for them. And 56% said it's gone better than expected. So that was really the most important message out of this, is that we have undergone a gigantic labor market experiment in remote working, and for more than half, it's working better than they expected, and only about 1 out of 10 has been working less well than they expected.
Maybe expectations were really low, Adam. Why do you think there was so much suspicion that working from home would lead to a huge drop in productivity? Was there actual evidence that people were relying on, or was it the old school conviction that put a premium on FaceTime and first into the office, last out of the office?
You know, I think when you're talking about working in a kind of totally different way, that people are just hesitant to make the jump sometimes. And I think also if what they're doing now works for them, you don't want to be the one who suggests to the company to make a big change and then it doesn't work and then you've kind of got egg in your face. So, you know, what we hear from a lot of Upwork clients who are talking about going remote or thinking about going remote is that there's a lot of status quo bias in companies, and obviously that's truer for bigger companies who are sort of more comfortable working the way they are. Smaller companies have always been more comfortable taking the risk, trying a new way of doing things. And so, you know, this is something we've been seeing with Upwork clients for 20 years, is that there's, you know, there's a hesitance to go remote, especially when the status quo is working, but once you do it, you see a lot of really big, important benefits.
Have you seen in the surveys that you've done, Adam, have you seen any sort of commentary with regards to costs, whether employers think that the remote work for a longer period of time might be more cost effective or more expensive?
So that's what's really interesting about this, is that we've had such a positive response from hiring managers, even though a lot of the benefits for remote work tend to accumulate in the long run. So when you go remote, that means you are no longer limited to just hiring in your local labor market. You can hire anywhere you want. All of a sudden, you know, labor markets all over the U.S. are open to you. You can hire talent no matter where it lives. And that's a benefit that they're not really seeing yet when they're just sort of short-term transitioning their team. So I think that as they, you know, continue to work remote, which a lot of them are going to, and they experience that, you know, you can hire remote workers all over the U.S. You're not just tied to what are often very high cost of living labor markets. They are going to see cost benefit from that. And that doesn't mean workers are even necessarily any worse off, because, you know, when you live in San Francisco, it's true, you might make more than a programmer who lives in Cleveland. But, you know, a lot of that is eaten up by high housing costs. So I think when, you know, these companies are able to truly look at the U.S. as like one giant labor market for some skills, mm-hmm. and they can hire workers wherever they are, I think workers and businesses are going to see, you know, costs go down.
And that's a really good point. Connor Sen, one of our Bloomberg Opinion columnists, wrote that Facebook is really pro-remote work right now, but a big reason is because eventually it can hire more people from outside Silicon Valley and pay them lower wages because the cost of living is so much lower. Do you think that's why these technology companies are so eager to jump on the work-from-home bandwagon, because the goal overall is to bring down their expenses when it comes to compensation?
No, I think that that's part of the story, but that ignores a lot of really important benefits that we saw in our survey. So the number one benefit they saw was a lack of commute. You also had fewer unnecessary meetings and reduced distractions at the office. And also, for one-third, productivity went up. So even before you start talking about cost savings from hiring workers in places where housing is less expensive, you have these really direct, immediate benefits that for some companies, and again, it doesn't have to be for all companies. As long as it's for some, that can mean a really big increase in remote work. For some companies, and a significant percent of them, they're seeing lots of direct, immediate benefits just from the workers, how they work together now.
That does it for this episode of What You Missed This Week. If you like this, please make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And be sure to tune in to our Market Close show every weekday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg Television and from 4 to 5 p.m. streaming on Twitter. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.